I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This season, prepare for every season with the Allbirds Mizzle Collection. These shoes were made for adventures in rain, shine, mist, or snow. Go to allbirds.com and use code FRESHSOCKS for a free pair of socks with purchase.
Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, A Love Letter to the Women Who Shape Us, out now in paperback. For our fifth series of Your Book, we're in the USA. This time we're back in Brooklyn and hanging out with the fabulous Shelby Lawman, author of Awards for Good Boys and creator of the hugely popular Instagram account of the same name, also with Shelby's dog, Clem. We talked about disappointing endings. Should you write to an author and complain? Past Shelby did. We also looked at what it's like when half your book collection is still lining the shelves of the people who once broke your heart, and how it really feels to watch your own book going out into the world. Enjoy. I love that. So that's the apparently Meghan Markle, when she was allowed to have a blog, that was her system, was the piling of the books to create an attractive shelf.
I just weirdly had so many orange and red books and a lot of pale pinks, as you can see. So I was like, you know, it's so easy. It's what I do everywhere. It's like the cheapest apartment hack in the entire world is just take a bunch of books that look fine together, and then I just like put a thing on it.
There's a beauty there. You've got a couple of my favorites. Idiot and the Lucia Berlin book, A Manual for Cleaning Women.
Such a good book. So this was also one of my favorites. The Rings of Saturn. I love a mixed media book, obviously.
Oh, can we see?
Oh, yeah.
I do not know that title. So this is W.G. Siebold.
Yeah, my literary professors somewhere are like thrilled that that I pulled out Siebold. So most of his books, I think, are mixed media. This one focuses a lot on walking and like body as movement. It's
lots of underlining.
Yeah.
Is that your original copy, or did you?
This is my original copy. I read it in school, so as you can see, this was a really poignant.
What the literal fuck?
It's a really poignant marginalia note that I made. Clearly, like, really, really taken by that. Yeah, that one says cool.
Nice. Are they butterflies or moths? They look like, maybe they're a bit more mothy.
His work is really somber. It's really, really somber, but it's also really beautiful. And I had a phase because I, you know, was trying to be a film boy for a second, and that felt like the right book to be reading for that.
Of course, it's quite kind of cinematic and atmospheric.
Yeah. I mean, I had this one class in college that was all about mixed media and hybrid books and movies, and it just totally influenced my work forever and kind of, you know, is why I am a writer and illustrator. I was like, why do one when I could just do both?
Do you very much feel like absolutely both? You don't feel like one is more the thing
it's
that you
such a
want
crisis.
To do first?
I feel like I also, please sit down. I'm like the worst, absolute worst host.
Oh, no, it's fine. I'll be up so I can kind of...
All right, yeah.
I am going to try not to like mess up the books too much and put them back where I found them.
There's no order. There's no rhyme or reason to where anything is. Yeah, I feel like I... Each day I like have a different order to how I name what I do. Sometimes I'm like, I'm a comedian, and then other times I like have a panic about calling myself that, and then I'm like, the world's my stage, I'm a comedian, and then the next day I'm like, I'm firmly a cartoonist, and then other times I'm like, the cartooning is a vessel for me to get my writing out there, which is true, but I think that I've just kind of accepted that I am multiple. Really, Clem? You're really involved, huh? I feel pretty freed by being able to have different mediums to express what I'm thinking about. I mean, the comics kind of started because I was like, I have these big, heady ideas. No one's going to read them. Like, not that no one's had these ideas before, but just like I was writing stuff for the internet at the time. I could see how long people were spending on my articles. No one cared. I was like, I have to develop a way to like hold people's attention and like, you know, make this small thing that represents a much larger point. Yeah, and the cartoons have been really... have been great, yeah.
Fine,
yeah, where do you want to be, huh?
Can you tell me about this bit, Giuliana Bruno, at the Submation? I don't know that either, but I love how huge it is.
It's giant. Like, honestly, I haven't read it. It's just, it's a book that I got from a friend. You can move anything in the world. I love gifting books and I love receiving books. And so I was like, this is a large pink book that I love.
Journeys in art, architecture, and film.
Also, I do have, I'm obsessed with automatons and statues and sculptures and anything like golems, anything that comes to life. And I saw that this book had a chapter, and so when someone gave it to me, I was like, oh, excellent.
All right, and while we're here on the pile, Elizabeth Bishop, who, for shame, I also don't know, but I love when people have poetry.
Yeah, I'm not a huge poetry person, which I know is, like, scandalous, but I am fond of Elizabeth Bishop. I have a lot of friends who are poets. I know a lot of people who, like, are such avid poetry readers, and doesn't do much.
When did you start reading Elizabeth Bishop? I'll try that again. When did you start reading Elizabeth Bishop? When did she come into your life?
I think in high school, we had to memorize a poem. And I definitely did a Bishop poem.
Oh, can I don't you remember which one?
No, of course not. Terrible memory. I could, you know, I wonder if I could. Wow, these are like crunchy. That's always good, Clem, right? I destroy my books, which I think is, like, to other readers, maybe, like, alarming, but all my books look extremely red because I just, like, I shove them in my bag, I write in them, I break the spines when I'm, like, trying to, you know, read them flat. I just absolutely destroy them.
I feel like people are either one extreme or the other. Yeah. You know, it's sort of, like, pristine, alphabetized, or it's like, let's go to town.
My books look very, very loved is how I will refer to them. But yeah, I mean, I just like to, when I'm reading books, I feel like they become very much like a part of my life. So they're just going everywhere with me. And
are your friends still happy to kind of, to lend them to you on that basis? Or has anyone said, okay, maybe not this one?
I think if I, when people lend me books, I like have to be really delicate. It's a concerted effort where I'm like, I'm not gonna write in this or like destroy it.
Remind myself, oh, I can't take this in the bath. It's not mine.
Yeah. And then when I lend books, people are like, what did you do to this book? Like, this is horrible. And I'm like,
like this when I found it.
Yeah. You're gonna learn all of the places that really spoke to me while you read my copy of this. I don't write in books as much anymore. I had a real phase of really embarrassing marginalia, as you could see, of just like, oh my gosh, like, yes, this.
What was the last book that you lent to someone? Have you got anything out on loan at the moment?
Oh, I do. I have the first three issues of Saga, which is a graphic novel. Those are with someone. I actually don't remember who I gave them to.
If you're listening, remember, yeah, please, you got them and
please give them back. I have lent some of my favorite books to people for various reasons I'm no longer friends with or talking to. So there are just some books that I have released into the world and it feels like, you know, some metaphor where I'm like, take this cherished book of mine, it is yours now.
What have you lost? Will you ever replace them? Or what do you think?
I lost this amazing mixed media book called Don't Let Me Be Lonely, An American Lyric. It was Claudia Rankine's, one of her early books. And she's a brilliant poet and lyricist and essayist. And that book just like totally revolutionized how I thought of what books could be and how. And it's really long and thin and beautiful. Yes, I gave that to someone I am no longer speaking to. And
I mean, that's quite an intense book to sort it of to
is.
Have.
It really is. It's
someone else to have. He's not in your life.
Yeah. Well, make yourself at home, Clem. What else do I have on Len that I'll never get back? Oh, there's this great book by Nell Zink called The Wall Creeper.
I love that book.
It's amazing. It's like my favorite first line in like any book. I'm not going to remember it exactly, but it's just, it's so jarring. It's about how like she gets in an accident and then like loses the baby. And I remember reading it and just being like, oh my God, this is how the book is starting.
So is that the one, because I read it exactly the same time as, is it Mislaid?
Yeah.
And the Wool Creep, but they're in Germany,
yeah.
Right? And it's, they've got the bird.
Yes.
And her partner, husband sort of goes and gets very into like drugs and hiking and techno music.
Yes. And it becomes that like kind of like eco-terrorist. Mm. It's such a cool book. Yeah, I don't know who I lent that to. It's gone.
I loved it because it felt like, I'm sure there is a real, you know, form and structure and it is probably, you know, quite traditional in lots of ways, yeah. But I felt like it was just so unexpected and so comfortably so,
yeah.
That it was, sometimes everything happened and sometimes nothing happened. You were just constantly being turned and twisted.
It was such a surreal read. I remember just feeling like so disoriented but also like very grounded in this woman's perspective of what was happening. And yeah, after I read that like I got so much Nell's Ink. I was like, this is very cool.
I love that when you find an author and you're like, there's more.
Yes. Oh, it's the best thing. You just like start to get a feel for what they're doing and what they've done before and just get to wait for their next stuff. And yeah, I'm a huge fan.
When you were a kid, were there any books like that where you found an author or a voice and thought, this is made for me?
Oh, that's a great question. I was and am a very avid sci-fi reader. And I remember like the first few kind of like fantasy sci-fi things I read where I was like, oh, like this is my genre. Like this feels great. I read, this is so embarrassing. I was like really invested in the endings of books that I read as a kid to the point where I felt like everyone needed to know my opinions on it. So I remember, like, I don't remember this, but my mom reminds me of this, is that I read The Giver, hated the ending, and then wrote a letter to the author about how I did not like the ending. I was like a child, and I was just like, here's my take on the ending of your published book.
Did they reply?
I'm not sure. I don't know if they did. But yeah, I did that a lot where I was just like, I would make my own endings to things. I would just like write my own stories. Like I was always had opinions on the way that other people did things, which is, you know, exactly what I do now. I'm just like a pretentious asshole, which is serves me well.
Was your mum reading those books too? Or were you sharing any books or reading together?
We did share books. There was a time where like me, my sister and my mom, we're all reading Harry Potter together, which was very sweet. And like, I was very much part of the fandom, like would go to the bookstore to line up for Harry Potter to be released.
Was that a character that you would like to dress as or kind of channel?
I think that I would just like put on a robe and a hat and like a wand. And I was just like, here I am. I mean, I just loved feeling like everyone was as excited about books as like I always felt like I was. Like I was like, oh, we're going to line up at the bookstore tonight. Like, this is amazing. Usually and we're like going to Blockbuster.
This is my time.
I was like, I felt really like at home, at peace with, I mean, in the years past, I've like have very different opinions about everything, but like growing up with that such excitement for a book release. I mean, I haven't seen anything really like that since.
Well, I felt a little bit like that way about The Testaments, which, you know, I have opinions about the ending. I might write to Margaret Atwood.
I haven't read it, yeah.
But I was so excited to see how excited everybody was.
Yeah.
And that it's about the sequel to a book that is such a sort of a fierce feminist classic. You know, it's not like everybody, you know, lining up to read new Jonathan Franzen.
Yeah.
Poor Jonathan Franzen.
He's my token male author that I make fun of, which I feel fine about, but it is like he really gets shit on.
I do that a lot on this podcast.
Yeah.
Shitting on Jonathan Franzen.
I mean, he writes women. I mean, this is a problem with many dudes. Mm. It's just like the way that they write women is like just stock type men writing women, and it's so cringeworthy.
We are all looking at our tits in a mirror at all times.
It's horrible. It's so, it sounds like, my dad wrote a porno sometimes. You're like, what is, like, this is just so, it's so cringy.
Are there any male authors who you think get it right?
Oh, totally. Totally, totally. I'm not someone, maybe this is, like, to my detriment, who is like, I'm not reading any white men. Like, no, no, no. Like, you know, I absolutely think that, like, many people are wonderful writers and can create captivating stories.
And I think it's really difficult, you know, not to. Really. Yes, you've really got to kind of create your own canon.
I mean, you absolutely can. I think that, like, to do it out of sort of, like, I'm not reading any white men as this, like, political statement. I get that. I, like, agree with it. For me and, like, my reading tastes, like, it's just always going to be a bit all over the place. I certainly just by what I'm drawn to and by choices I make end up reading more women, especially women of color. But, like, yeah, I'm not, like, absolutely no. That would, like, take off a huge chunk of my books that I return to. Which men get it right? It's a good question. I recently read How to Write an Autobiographical Novel by Alexander Chi. And that was really brilliant. He's really brilliant.
I don't know that. But
I'll show it to you. It's red. It was in my red folder. Yeah, I'm trying to see. I thought Kim Stanley Robinson was a woman until I learned recently that they're not.
Oh, thank you so much. So Alex Chi is one of the most important writers, one of our most important writers, and we should listen to every damn thing he has to say from Jamie Attenberg, so you know it's good. So is this a novel? Or
it is and it isn't. It's very, like, meta-commentary on writing the thing itself and then just becoming a writer and his life.
So it's kind of auto-fiction?
Yeah. It was beautiful.
Oh, I should say, before I go, this is a handsome, handsome bookshelf.
Isn't it wonderful? Okay, the last apartment that I lived in, when we moved in, our previous tenants left all their furniture. We're just like, we can't. We're moving out of New York. We don't care. And none of my roommates wanted this. So I was like, I will have it. And this is going to be mine now. Yeah. Yeah, I'm looking to see...
Can come back to that. I've just, it's caught my eye. It's a really beautiful edition of Lydia Davis' stories.
Oh, the best. The absolute best.
I've not seen it. Oh, it's Picador. This looks like a book you have loved.
Yeah, I really, I feel like I've had that for years. I mean, I love all of the stories in there, but sometimes when I just really, like, need some emotional cutting, I read Break It Down and just cry. Because it is just heartbreaking. And it gets me every time. Every time it gets me. it's grim.
I think it's to write short stories of that kind of that intensity. And again, it's what you were talking about in terms of, you know, economy and having to saying something really big in a really small space. It's, I hate how talented she is.
it's cool. I want to return to reading more short stories, honestly. I had quite a phase, and now I read mostly nonfiction and sci-fi. Those are, like, the two poles that I am sort of straddling at all times.
Do you feel like there's a gap between kind of what you read for pleasure and what you read when you're kind of in that work headspace?
The stuff that I make for work is stuff that I am always thinking about, whether I want to or not. But there is certainly, like, a place that I go to when I want to read and not be as kind of wrapped up in the stuff that I'm working on. Whereas, like, there are so many essays and nonfiction things and just there are so many ways to stay engaged. And so when I like to kind of, like, find another world to enter, I do it very literally where I'm like, I am reading this, like, 7-book epic about space and I'm just gonna be there and it'll be great.
I can understand how hugely appealing that is. And I think it's maybe similar to kind of why Harry Potter is so loved. It's a universe that you can allow to consume you.
Oh, absolutely.
I think now as well, the real world is increasingly less appealing.
Oh, it's bad out there. And the best sci-fi, the best books of any kind, you know, they don't let you off the hook. They force you to think about how it's still our world, how it's still people, how people are still horrible monsters, regardless of where they are. And so I'm never looking for, not that there's anything wrong with, like, a quote-unquote beach read, you know, who cares? But when I want my beach read, I want it to be, like, I want a galaxy, I want some weird politics, I want some gender bending, you know, a molecule, weird, you know, I want it all.
On that theme, I just spotted, and I have to start asking about books I don't know, and not books I do know, but I love that book, Paul Takes the Form of Mortal Girl by Andrea Lawler.
I finished that, like, a month or two ago. I loved it, and it left me feeling really uneasy, which I think as a cis person and as a relatively sometimes straight person, I was like, you know, I should feel uncomfortable with this, and it left me a lot to think about. Oh, I do have other books on loan. Wow. I'm missing a lot.
I see some Claudia Rankine that survived the loaning.
Yeah, I think I have Citizen still.
Yeah, that's the one I saw, I think.
Yeah, but so grim. I got it. This is really just reminding me that I have to send some angry texts about what people have done with my books. Yeah, what else am I reading? I mean, I have a lot of graphic novels and...
Oh, I'm just in David Hockney's Dog Days.
Oh, yeah.
I was very, very, very tempted to buy an early edition of this in the Strand for like $10 million or something.
So cool.
I won't go home. It's fine. I'll just stay here by the glass case.
Yeah, it was a gift from my ex's mother. It was very nice of her.
Oh, I love that line drawing of sleepy dogs.
Yeah, my family has dachshunds. My mom glitched and was like, only dachshunds from here on out. So... I have, you know, dachshunds in the family. Yeah, what else am I reading? Oh, I loved this. Let's see where this one is. This is like one of the series from N.K. Jemisin, but my favorite was another one, which I wonder if I have. Yeah, this is the Inheritance trilogy. That was cool too. Yeah, I just like...
So what happens in The Killing of the Moon? Where are we?
I think what is this one? There's a lot of dream stealing in here.
N.K. Jemisin has the most amazing author photos. It's really beautiful.
It's just
and really...
so good. When people are like, what sort of sci-fi, what fantasy should I read? I am just like, if you're trying to do contemporary stuff, N.K. Jemisin is like, her world building is just so beautiful. It's obviously like still so profoundly related to things that we are thinking about and talking about today. And I just think that, like, if you're going to start engaging with sci-fi or fantasy, like, why not start by reading Black women who are writing today rather than, like, oh, you know, I'm going to read this 200-year-old white man talking about the moon. It's like, okay, how are people interpreting this genre that has, like, so often been used to, like, reframe society's problems or to make you look at, like, another version of things? And so, yeah, that's always my go-to.
Oh, this sounds amazing. Dragons and hateful spirits haunt the flooded streets of New Orleans in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. In a parallel universe, a utopian society watches our world trying to learn from our mistakes. A black mother in the Jim Crow South must save her daughter from a fae offering impossible promises. And in the Hugo Award-nominated short story, The City Born Great, a young street kid fights to give birth to an old metropolis's soul. So this is a collection of stories.
Yes, it is.
And that's definitely something that I'm going to... buy before the trip is out. Oh, yeah, I think that's such a good point as well. And I think perhaps as well, there are so many people who feel like sort of sci-fi and, you know, dystopian writing isn't for them because it's old white dudes.
Right.
And, you know, that feels like it's for everyone.
And it's like also, oh, this is such a cool copy of The Left Hand of Darkness. Not as cool as the one I have.
It's the most beautiful edition
isn't
I've ever seen.
Beautiful?
It's gorgeous. It's kind of... I sort of like, how would you describe that blue? It's like sky blue, a shade lighter than cobalt with this sort of very, what's
just
that
so
font?
So cool.
It's very sort of 70s, I think. A bit Boogie Nightsy, but.
It is a little bit Boogie Nightsy.
Like, where have I seen that before?
Yeah.
Kind of shimmery, silvery.
Oh,
turquoise.
I love this edition, but it's not as cool. I have like a pile of books that I've stored.
Sorry, did we say what that is?
The Left Hand of Darkness.
Left Hand of Darkness
by Ursula K. Le Guin. I love like 70s and 80s art covers, and so I have like a stack of those, but they are precious, so they are in my parents' basement, because where else would I...
That's where the precious things go. Like sci-fi ones, or is that just, you know,
yeah,
anything?
I love like weird old covers, like this I bought just because I loved the cover so much. I do love the book, but like I really just like this machete, I just loved it. I don't even know who
is
did
that,
it.
What's that, Bantam Books. I see a lot of those editions. They've all got those fabulously lurid...
Oh, it's just such good...
...dramatic covers. Oh, sorry, and that book is A Death in the Family by James Agee.
Let's see what else we got here. More Le Guin. Oh, such a great series. talking about white men I love. Garth Nix. What a great trilogy. I think A Porson is the last one. It is about... Yes, Sabriel is the first one, and then Liriel is the second. It is about these people with specific powers, where they can traverse the realm of the dead, and then also send the ones that creep over into the world of the living back to the dead through these special flutes. It's really wonderful. Oh, I just read this.
The Ninth House. Ninth House by Dugo. Sorry, there's no V. I threw that in there.
I really liked it, and I really want there to be a second one right now. I'm really impatient. It just came out. It ended in a way where I was like, oh, like, you're setting this up for more. So I'm, like, praying that there's more, because I just really loved the world, and I felt like I fell into it really easily. And now, as often happens when I finish a book, I'm like, ah, where'd they go? Like, I just made these friends for a few days and now they're gone.
Do you ever reread books?
You know, I reread a lot of nonfiction things when I'm like, oh, how did that person phrase this? Or like, what did this sound like? Like, Rebecca Traister, I go back to a lot. This book, Eloquent Rage by Brittany Cooper, I go back to a lot.
Oh, I don't know this.
Oh, yeah, it's really cool. I made myself like a mini syllabus of books about anger, women's anger, last year. And it was really, really fascinating. I'm trying to think. There are definitely books that I've read multiple times. Honestly, I think Housekeeping is probably the only book I've read more than 3 times.
Oh, that's so spooky. That just came up, I think, on the that we just recorded with Ada Calhoun.
Oh, cool.
He said it's, I think, did she say her favorite book?
When people are like, what's your favorite book? And I feel overwhelmed by that question, I always feel good saying Housekeeping, because it just is the most beautiful book. Like, I feel good about changing my feelings about what I'm reading at a given time, because, like, I'm like, Housekeeping is, it's in my pocket. Like, this is the one, like, I read it and I was like, how can you be saying so much when this is about, like, emptiness and nothingness, but I mean, it's also so much just about like family life.
Well, this sentence leapt out at me from the back. The family house is in the small far west town of Fingerbone.
Yeah, the Finger Lakes. It's like, it's like extremely Finger Lake centric. It's a really amazing book, and she just, it's one of those things. I don't know, when I read books like that or writing like that, I just feel so almost relieved that I'll like never create anything that good. Like, it's just so genius that it just kind of, to me, is a relief where I'm like, you are incredible. If you are an artist, and I will strive to be better, but I will never be comparing myself to you, because like, thank you for making this. So that's that's really how I feel about it.
I don't know how you feel about it, but I think now it's really difficult because there are so many people making amazing things,
it's, and it's so hard,
yeah, to be in the, and to kind of be, to read what you love, but yes, also to feel like you can just love it and you don't need to go and kind of get on your, you know, one's sort of internet soapbox and be like, I need to talk about that. And that every, I think, having opinions about everything. Well,
yeah,
obviously, if you want to write a letter to an author, you don't like the ending, go right ahead.
I hated this ending, yeah.
I know that there are books that feel like they're outside this sort of shouty urgency,
and
it's not something you have to kind of be keeping up with. It's just there for you.
It's true. There's something really amazing about that, and also kind of grim about it. And I think it's like, to me, it's explained why I've gravitated more towards books that I like have read, or where the authors are like not very online. And like, the weird thing is, like, now I am sort of becoming that. Like, I'm finding that I like am online and I'm talking about my book and people are like in my comment section, and I'm like way too accessible for what I thought like authors should be. I'm like, I'm just right here.
Well, you know, because I find that really hard. Hey, and I think you probably, you know, have it sort of 1,000 times more than I do, that like, I don't want to be online as much as I am, but I feel sort of obliged. Like, it might die if I don't keep stoking the fire.
Every day I'm like, oh, do you remember I have a book out? And everyone's like, yeah, like, we hate this. Like, just move on. And I'm like, oh gosh, but please read this. Like, it's just, it's a really, and I have talked to many other people who kind of feel that weird split of feeling compelled to stay online, and also like, I need it for so many aspects of my career. And then just being like, to me, sometimes I'm like, I think my personality online and this persona that I am actually is like a detriment to the work that I'm doing outside of being online. Like, my book is very measured and very thoughtful, and online I'm like shouting in all caps at all times. And I'm just like, oh, I hope that like
I find it quite flattening.
Yeah.
You know, that I can't... And it's weird because what being online has done has meant that not only has it made me, I think, a worse writer,
yes.
It's also meant that I find it much harder than I ever used to even like take an hour to just yep. be in my head, which is really your only job as a writer, yeah. is to be by yourself in your own head and be comfortable with that.
No, it's okay. Truly, it's so hard. I keep having this thought of like, okay, I'm in the midst of kind of creating next projects. I need to take a Twitter break. I need to not. And then I'm like, okay, but how am I getting, that's how I get my news. Mm. That's how I talk to my friends. That's how I stay connected. And so it's very surreal to try to pick, like, okay, I need the silence and solitude of, like, letting my brain marinate in these ideas and thinking about them. But I also am, like, addicted to technology and social media, and I'm not giving myself any time to really think about what I want to be writing about. And it just keeps, it's going so fast. So it's, like, to think of, like, okay, I'm going to stay offline and write something thoughtful, I'm like, well, what if everyone's like really moved on by that
yeah.
point, you know? Like,
it stokes a bad anxiety, doesn't it? And it's like, I feel it's just like, the world is ending, be very yes. afraid, I've won a prize, and that's all that's sort of yes. being yelled at you.
It's really hard to balance, like, you know, kind of what to do in the in between. Obviously we know, like, things are extremely grim and we should be shouting about those things at all time, and doing anything else can sometimes feel like really, you know, out of character.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
We'll be back to Shelby soon, but now it's time for my Steal of the Week, a book that's so rich in impact it should have been written in beluga caviar on cashmere pages, although I'm glad it wasn't because that would make it really hard to read. This week it's The Female Persuasion by Meg Wolitzer, the story of Greer, young, gifted and broke, whose life is changed by an encounter with the celebrity feminist speaker Faith Frank. This book is so full, smart and tender. It's a lacerating, painful and funny close examination of our attitudes to class, money and womanhood. Wolitzer is a writer of great honesty, compassion and subtlety. The realness of this book broke my heart. Every character is so vivid and recognisable, and they're allowed to revel in their own humanity. But it's also a book that forces its readers to call themselves to account. Also, it's over 400 pages long, but I still felt genuinely bereft when I reached the end and had to part company with Greer, Z, Faith and Corey. The Female Persuasion by Meg Wolitzer is published by Chateau and Windus, and it's out now. Now, back to Shelby.
Oh, I just read this and it was so good. I read it in like a day. It's called My Sister the Serial Killer. And it's about that, but it's also just really about, I have a sister, so, you know, it's about just family and relationships and what it means to love someone who is like a narcissist, and like what it means to love someone and care about someone even when they're like really literally destroying everything around them. It was also just so funny, and I was not expecting that. Everyone who had told me to read it, I kind of got the vibe that it was like a thriller, and I was like really pleasantly surprised by like how dark and funny it was.
Because I think that's because people, this book has been recommended to me by so many people,
yeah.
and I really, really, really want to read it. And that's a bit of me, it's like, oh, I don't like serial killer books.
But it's so funny. It like really is.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it really was, you know, it's dark and gritty, but it was so much more about this really like delicate, complex relationship between these sisters.
Because I think having written my own book about having many sisters,
yeah.
I've got five.
Yeah.
I think this is especially true in the past when they'd be like, we want to write a book about the relationships women have with each other because that's interesting, but how can
yeah.
we justify that because it's women? And
right.
that there are so many sisters
yeah.
in books, and when you start
yeah.
looking, they're everywhere.
Yeah. I felt like that about the Elena Ferrante books. I was like, this is the best relationships between women that I have read in a while, but I felt like the way people were talking about them was just like, there had to be something, like people were just trying to make it, And there are so many amazing aspects about that book. Like, I really loved the series. But I remember people talking about them with this sort of, like, I feel like people wanted it to be more than just compelling look at female friendships. And it obviously was, but I also don't think that there was anything wrong with it being, like, an excellent version of that. And so it was weird being like, you know, these are obviously these books, like, they show this woman's political progression. They kind of break wide open when you keep reading them, and it's really incredible form.
Yeah. In her relationship with her mother. But it can be a book that's quite, I suppose, you don't need anything dramatic to happen beyond life happening and a woman's life and women's lives happening.
Right.
Although I did recently, someone was saying, I really need, like, a sort of, you know, a lovely winter read to make me feel like I'm in the Naples sunshine. Yeah. Shall I read the Neapolitan novels? And I said, no, like,
really,
they're amazing, but
they're
brutal. Yeah. You know, this is like, you're in Pasolini country. Oh, you don't want to.
I totally lost myself in those books. I was like, this is,
Did you read them back to back? Because I had to take a minute. I had to almost shake myself off and really pace it.
I read them. Yeah, I read them all back to back. I couldn't stop. And it was like, I think it was the summer that they were like, kind of re-released here. It was like when all of the fervor around them kind of, like, you know, became alive again. And I just remember I was on the train and I would see, like, so many other people reading them, and we would just be like, it was just this wild, like, oh, this is like the book of the moment. Like, you know, there are times where you're like on a train, you can kind of see what people are reading at a given time. This is also one of my favorite books, May We Be Forgiven by A.M. Holmes, and it is really disgusting. I've had this book for a long time. The pages are like, there's coffee on it.
Dust jacket.
It's just, what does the cover look like? I couldn't even tell you. This is one of the first books I remember. A writing teacher that I really, really valued recommended this to me when I left his class. I was like, what should I read? And he said, Maybe Be Forgiven by M. Holmes and Swimming Home. It is, yeah. It's about a really dysfunctional family, you know, as many novels are, but it's so weird and so dark and so funny, and it just, like, goes in places that it's really incredible.
I love how just flipping through, I really love a dialogue heavy book. If you've got somebody good at dialogue, and
I know, to me, I'm constantly amazed by that, because, like, I stick to nonfiction and humor writing, because, like, I don't know what dialogue should sound like.
Do you think you will have a try fiction one day when you're feeling,
you know, I used to write fiction, it was always, like, very, you know, close to home, you could say. And I honestly, these days, I feel more inspired trying to help people understand real things in the world, and kind of unpacking that. And that doesn't mean that fiction is off limits. And, you know, I make up a lot of things in my writing and in my art. It just so happens that, like, it's rooted in things that people recognize. So it's never, like, this invented thing. It's like, oh, that's happened to a friend of mine. Yeah, I mean, also, I love Anne Carson. I lied when I said I don't know any poetry. Anne Carson is an amazing poet. I really would just do anything for her.
Oh, wow, that's another incredible edition. Yeah. It comes in a beautiful presentation book.
It is a elegy to her brother, and so the book itself is, like, very coffin-like, and it's a palimpsest, so, like, you've got all of these pages together, and it's just, like, her processing this death, and it's really beautiful. It's really heartbreaking. You can also spread it out, which I love.
Presented in such an amazing way.
It's really just incredible. And her newest book also is in, like, this beautiful folio box. I haven't gotten it yet, but I see it around and I'm just, like, itching for it. It's just so cool.
A book I wanted to ask about, which is a really insensitive segue, Stiff, The Curious Lies of Human Cadavers. Yeah. This looks amazing. Why do you have this?
You know, I like gross things. I also, for a really brief moment in time, was helping out with this podcast that was all about death. And a lot of it was, like, you know, learning about how Americans came to kind of view death and, like, why the grieving process is different here. And so I was like, I'm going to go in there. Honestly, I had to stop reading after a little bit. I was just like, I don't think that I can do this at this moment in time.
What do you think is different about death in America compared with other places?
At this moment in time, it's so bizarre because on the one hand, like when we were talking about Twitter, like death is so flattened. Like it is happening all of the time in every way, shape and form. And we are constantly inundated to hearing about it and like desensitized to it in that way. So it's like unbelievable. And at the same time, I think like the grieving process is already like less from what I understand, and this might be me combining stereotypes around America and other places, but from what I've understood, and I feel like just the grieving process here is much more closeted than it is in other places, and much more processed, and crying really loudly at funerals I think is something that would be like, you know, not looked down upon, but not something that was like, oh, normal human outpouring of emotion when someone died. Like there are these kind of rules and etiquette here that I think are very learned and very indicative of, you know, a lot of things.
The UK, you feel as though there's almost a time limit on it. You can be sad, you know, up until this point, and then, you know, the person has a funeral and then you're like, okay, you've done your grieving and mourning. Like, no, really not.
Yeah, it's so interesting. There are definitely, I mean, I think this is true everywhere. We just have really specific ideas around what grief looks like and like what the grieving process should be. And the reality is that we just never know.
Are there any fictional grievings that you have gone through, or characters that you've loved and missed?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly feel like every time I finish a book, there's like a microscopic grief in and of that where I'm like, I have just gotten so close to these people and they just like accompanied me on this, you know, journey through my life. And now I've closed the book and they're gone.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
For a very kind of concentrated period of time.
It's just really, it hurts.
I love rereading because they're my friends. And the first time I read the book, I'm making sure they're all okay at the end. And then when I know what happens, like, I know you're going to be fine. I can just enjoy spending time with you.
I know. I need to be better about rereading. Honestly, I have so much anxiety about not being able to read everything, which like, obviously I'm not going to be able to read everything, but it's this very like, this base instinct where I'm like, I'm going to try.
Do you find you are just reading all the time as a matter of course, or is it something that you need to make time for and schedule a little bit?
I mean, I've hacked the world in having the truth that like reading is a huge part of my process, and like I think that's true for so many writers, is that like reading other people's work is like so essential to being able to do what we do.
I think you almost have to be, the only rule for being a writer is to be a reader. Maybe.
And I feel like every interview I've listened to with writers that I respect have said some version of this where I'm like, oh good, like that makes a lot of sense to me. Like I spend so much of my time absorbing other people's visions of the world and how they view things. Yeah, I love reading in like in any circumstance, and like I will read on the train, I'll read in cars. I'm not someone who walks and reads. Like this is a crucial point.
It really makes me quite anxious when I see people doing that.
I'm not trying to. I actually just started this book, Milkman.
And
like in the first few pages, like one of the characters, like central, like, you know, quote unquote flaws is that she's walking and reading at the same time. Yeah, that book, I'm only like 20, 30 pages in, and I have felt so disoriented in the best way.
I mean, there's a little bit of me that's like, well, maybe it's okay in rural Ireland, 70s, fewer cars.
Yeah.
I was so excited when that won the Booker because I feel as though that's something, again, a little bit like maybe the Ferrante novels, where it's a very close examination of something that, you know, a woman is going through. And in the past, maybe someone would have come like, but there needs to be more. Right. And you need to be like,
and you're like, okay, well, what are all of these books by men about? It's literally the same thing. Like, in addition to Franzen, I also often pick, what's the guy who did 5 volumes of My Struggle?
Nosegard.
I'm sure they're excellent. And like, but just the premise of like how people respond to those, like versus how they respond to other like serialized works by other people is just like, okay.
Can you imagine going to like your agent or your publisher and saying, so I've got this idea?
Oh, she's amazing. Anne Leckie. is a sci-fi author. I think I did lend out the first one, but she has this series called Ancillary Justice, and it's this like kind of genderless surveillance state future, and the main character is a warship, like a sentient ship who is like living in a human body. It's so wild. I loved that. I think I read that kind of at the same time that I was reading the first one of this, To Like the Lightning, which is by Ada Palmer. And also, I guess it's sci-fi, maybe more fantasy. Also, it's really interesting, actually. Like, she plays around with gender a lot, but it's in this way where, like, it's so futuristic that, like, reverting to sort of, quote-unquote, like, typical gender norms is actually, like, way more subversive than anything else. So, like, it's in this, like, you know, like, techno society and, like, everything is, you know, automated. But then the sort of, like, the raunchy thing that they're hiding is, like, this group of elites kind of role-playing, like, Renaissance gender roles. Yeah, it's really cool.
That's the smartest concept.
It's so
like,
it's cool.
Breaking my brain. How'd you come up with that?
It's so cool. And, like, everyone lives in, like, these hives, which is, like, kind of how, you know, future living should be. So it was interesting. I also got this, which really just ruined my life. It's called The New Dark Age, Technology and the End of Future by James Bridle.
It's got a very cheerful primary colored cover for such a
ruined my
sad
life.
Book.
I actually had to skip a chapter. I had to skip the chapter about airplanes and like how climate is making. It's like of all of the things, you know, this book is horrifying in so many ways, but the thing that specifically horrified me was like, I'm terrified of flying. So the thing that was like really bad to me was like, oh, flying is actually going to be worse. And I was like, you know, even more reason why I'm going to just...
Worse for the world or worse as an experience?
Worse as an experience. And also obviously for the world, but it was like, oh, in addition to all of the pollutants, like actually the air is changing and flights are going to be worse. And I was like, I can't read this anymore. But yeah, it's a really interesting book that I think like very kind of cohesively makes literal what a lot of people are saying about technology. Like, it's so easy to just be like, technology's ruining us, blah, blah, blah. And this book is just like, literally, like, we're not talking about the infrastructure of these things. Like, there are fiber optic cables under the sea, they're eroding. Like, we gotta zoom out. So I loved that. But yeah, it destroyed me.
Because I think sometimes as well, there's a danger that we sort of think, oh God, it's all terrible, but it's inevitable. So let's not, breaking it down and being specific about what the problems are is really.
Totally.
It's something I know shamefully little about and I must learn more.
Yeah, these are another, speaking of white men who write things.
Good things?
It's great. It's actually two white men. So take that.
Oh God, I hate it when they make friends.
They make friends, they made friends, and then they made one name to write together. But
So is one called James and one called Corey?
I honestly don't even know their real names.
James S.A. Corey.
Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank are their real names. It's the pen name of them. Okay, the whole thing is called The Expanse, now a TV show. But it is like a Game of Thrones style epic, but it's in space. So you've got like in the, you know, forefront, you've got gritty politics between people who live on the belt and on the earth and on the space station, and then distant future there's like a huge unknown threat coming. And I just love that setup for like seven books. You know this thing is coming, and it's just, yeah, and I'm really in there. I've read them all.
Can you really immerse yourself?
I really have.
Squat.
Oh yeah, my small.
So these graphic novels here.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great one.
This is Beautiful Passing Human by Liana Fink.
Liana is the best. And then this is her new book. It's called Excuse Me. It's so cool. Liana was someone that I looked up to forever because she's just like so, so, so smart and so funny, and her art is really beautiful. And then I started cartooning and we became internet friends and became real friends. And it's just, it's really cool to see how like, oh my gosh, these people who were my absolute heroes are now people who I still look up to, but also consider my peers. And it just like, it blows me away.
So exciting. Have you got any other heroes who've become real life buddies?
Oh my God. Samantha Irby. I have her books are loaned out, or else I would be having them here right now because I just give my best books away.
I really like to think that in the future there'll be like one person listening to that. Oh my God, I have all of Shelby's books.
No, truly. It's like someone is going to pay for this. But you know, I love lending books to my friends. But yeah, Sam Irby is someone who like her essays just crack me up. I've read them forever. She just makes me laugh so hard and is so brilliantly funny and smart. We found each other on the internet and then ended up, you know, talking. And it's hard for me to comprehend because, like, to me, it still feels like this, like, oh my gosh, like, these are people that I, like, have been reading for years and they, like, know who I am and, like my work. Like, it just, the cognitive dissonance just jumps out. I'm like, I can't even process this. Like, it's way too cool.
You know, for all our complaining about the internet, I think, in a way, there's something kind of as democratic as anything can possibly be, where you don't have to wait to be at the right party or be introduced or, you know, know certain people. You can just say, here's my work, and people can find it and love it.
It's really fascinating. I mean, there is still, I think, like, so much weird stuff around book promotion and just writers online and the right way to be and the right way to promote your book. And there's so much, I just feel like there's just so many little politics of that I just, like, don't understand nor really want to at this moment in time. I'm just kind of letting it happen.
I think it's really, really hard. And, you know, because I do stuff where that I sort of feel obliged to do. And then other, right, like, I've got, you know, various friends who are sort of going through it at the moment, like with first books and things. And that, and it's weird that sort of, you almost want to say, you need to calm down. But I get it. I know how, and I know, and just feeling.
Yeah, it was also just so surreal. I was just so deluded into thinking that when my book released, everyone would read it immediately. And I was like, oh, everyone's going to know. And then I was like, oh, I'm going to be promoting this book for the rest of my life. Like, in addition to everything else that I create and will be promoting. Like, truly, like, it's so strange when you get so immersed in your own work.
I think so. And especially when you publish anything online and you know that if something has a reaction, it happens either in 24 hours or a week.
It's immediate.
And then you really, you know, I really struggled with it. Like,
No, everything, my entire, you know, project of Awards for Good Boys was like posting things online and immediately seeing people like them. And so I was working on this book in secret and then was just sort of like, okay, like, can't wait. Like, book release day, like, here it comes. And it was, like,
it's so
anticlimactic. Like, I was like, what's happening?
You think it's going to be, like, 1,000 times what you get when you have a really good post.
Oh, exactly. Like, I was like, everyone's going to just
run to the bookstore and take a day off work to read my book. What is this?
I was like, but this is so strange. It's almost as if, like, this is a material object that people have to go and, like, have the means to purchase. And there are so many other factors involved with just, like, me, you know, blasting out a comic for free. And it was a very good learning experience where I was just like, oh my gosh, I've been so spoiled by so many things, but by this instant gratification of people responding to my work. And then the eerie part is like, oh, everyone is, like, loving this thing that I made in 30 minutes, but this thing, this project that I put my heart and soul into and, like, you know, is actually the thing I care about, and everything is just a vessel for you to read this. Everyone's like, yeah, you know, someday.
It's so complicated as well because I think we do, when we see people, I find it very interesting. Oh, God. It's all right for them. They're always talking about all these great things they're doing. Like, my thing isn't good. I need to, and to know that everybody, however kind of, you know, super, super successful something seems, that actually it's.
Yeah. It also just feels like there are so many incredible people making work today. But because of just, like, how celebrity culture works and stan culture works, there are, like, 3 people allowed to be, like, the popular ones at any given time. And it's so much pressure for them, and it's also so much pressure for everyone else. Like, you have these, like, and I mean, it's kind of what I make work about, where it's like you have these few figures, you're putting them on a pedestal, you're not allowing them fallibility, you're not letting them be human. You're just like, this is the best person writing today. And it's like, not only is that so unfair to all of the millions of people who are so incredible, but it also just, like, it sets up the standard where it's like, you're not allowed to grow and evolve with this person that whose work you're consuming. And, like, they should be able to change, and you should be able to change, and maybe you won't like their next project, but you'll love this one. And
they should be able to make art that they're inspired to make, rather than feeling the pressure of having to follow up this thing.
Yeah. I got caught recently in a bookstore looking for my own book because I, like, came into the bookstore. I was, like, looking on all the tables, which was, like, really, it was bold of me to look around on the tables. It's not on the tables. It's, like, in the section it's supposed to be, and it's in the comedy section or the, like, illustrated section. And, like, the person who worked at the bookstore was like, are you Shelby? And I was, like, leaning down looking at my own book. And I was like, I just, Yep, I needed to make sure it was there. yeah, it's just like, it's so bizarre.
Whenever you're in the UK, this is something that my bookseller friends have told me, and yeah. I was like, really? Are you sure? They're really, really nice, friendly people who work in bookstores, and they yeah. love it. They want you to sign your books.
Oh, okay.
And the best thing as well is, I don't know if it's different here to there, but yeah. if you sign the book, then they've bought it. Yeah, they can't yeah. send it back.
I think they can send it back here.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, come to London.
Yeah.
Come and I will take you around all of my favourite bookstores and say, everybody, this is Shelby. Let you know, slap your signed copy stickers yeah. on there.
I would love that. I know the book is releasing again in the UK, and the only difference is, I mean, the cover is different, and there's no Oxford.
Do you have the UK version?
Yeah, you guys can have one. There's no Oxford comma. Let me get you a nicer one.
That's a beautiful hardback. We've got.
I know, so exciting.
The US one.
They got a little damaged in the post, but yeah, there's no Oxford comma, and I love it. It's so funny.
Are there any awards you would like to? I think you should do a tiny reading if you'd like, if that's okay. If there's anything you'd...
Oh, and the book is dedicated.
It is to my dog. It's quite embarrassing. Yes, a good girl. You are being a good girl. Yeah, I feel like this is very on brand. I'll read some of this. So this is a chapter called Pygmalion. In college, I was in a long-distance, quote-unquote, open, more on that later, relationship with a boy a few years older than me who lived in New York while I was finishing up school in Ohio. I received an unyielding stream of content about his own life that he released into the void of our primarily digital exchanges, demanding validation, being seen, being asked follow-up questions. Though he gave little in return, I told myself if I poured enough love and emotional labor into him, he would turn around and show me the same. In many ways, I was dating him because I wanted his life. His cool job, his ability to make money as an artist, doing what he loved. I knew, but decided not to notice, that he conveniently ignored the fact that I was an artist too, because I was young and not a professional like him, and my art and words came from a place of my own vulnerability and gasp emotionality. He was very much a logic or bust sort of man, and I was drawn to that too, because internalized misogyny told me my version of seeing the world was less than, and his was the North Star I should seek to follow. The short version is, he didn't want me as a partner. He wanted me as a cheerleader, someone to inspire him, to make him feel needed and loved and worthy, to keep him company while he waited for someone more suitable, not in college, not so emotional, to come along. During this time, I found comfort in ye old versions of my current boyfriend, other old white men and their art, who shined a light on the fucked upness of my then percolating ideas about men and their desires.
Huge thanks to Shelby. You can follow her at Awards for Good Boys on Instagram and at SD Lawman on Twitter. Awards for Good Boys, Tales of Dating, Double Standards and Doom is published by Penguin Books and out now. I'm Daisy Buchanan and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, fellow shelf obsessives. You can find me on Twitter at NotRollerGirl and on Instagram at TheDaisyB. Say hello, suggest some guests and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guest and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska, and it's hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with this from Philip Hall, who said this to our excellent podcast pals at Backlisted. Books are like friends. They always turn on you in the end. See you next time.